so I talked about Eric. Let me lie down so you can stomp me to a pulp. In my defense, let me say that while the conversation wasn't sparkling, it wasn't superficial either. He's a superb listener. And my God, these amazing chocolate brown eyes. And what was I saying? Oh yeah, he kept me talking about myself. And I wasn't bawling all over the table about Eric. I was just telling my story. And for the first time, I felt like I was telling a cohesive, coherent story, not all over the place and going off on ridiculous tangents. I finally put it all together with things I've learned in therapy, and I can see you're getting bored. No, I did not sleep with him. Feel free to stop reading. I'll just keep babbling. He did end up giving me a killer private tour of the museum on my day off and bought me lunch. He's 27, went to John Carroll University, art history major with a minor in, don't kill me, technical theater arts. It's my type. What do you want from me? He's getting his master's from Case Western Reserve, and you're bored again. I didn't sleep with him. God, he was hot, though. Fucking hurt to look at him. I need to get laid, don't I? We're getting ready to board. I'll post this when we reach DC. Miss you, darling girl. Love, love, love. Days. P.S. You're disgusted with me, aren't you? In parte dextra. The Bethesda Review, July 19, 1997. City Dance Conservatory welcomes guest artists Marguerite Bianco and Gabriel Osten, who are currently touring with a national production of Phantom of the Opera at the Kennedy Center through October. Bianco and Osten will teach ballet and contemporary classes during their residency. Bianco will also stage her work in progress, Rakewind, set to Mozart's Requiem Mass, for the Professional Artist Series at the Strathmore Music Center at the end of August. As a pen pal, Trey made no demands, save one. He insisted Daisy join the 20th century and get an email address.
"I know how much you love your quaint letters," he wrote, "but I have atrocious handwriting and no patience."
He called her nearly every Monday, her day off, either in the morning to hear what she had planned or in the late evening to hear what she had done. Their conversations, written or spoken, were long and interesting, but never flirtatious. Trey was open about his social life, but didn't mention a girlfriend. "Or a boyfriend, for that matter," Daisy said to Gabriel one night.
"For fuck's sake, he lives in Ohio," Gabriel said drowsily. "He couldn't be much more than a long-distance booty call. Too expensive. Take the friendship."
"You're right. He's good company."
"Bet he wouldn't scratch your back the way I do."
"Who could? My feet are cold. Can I put them on you?"
"Shit, no. Get those frigid claws away from me."
"We bicker like an old married couple. Isn't it adorable?"
"Woman, you put those feet near me and I will shiv you."
Daisy finished the section of Rakewind, set to the Confutatis Maledictis. She wondered if anyone would guess it was her interpretation of a pot and ecstasy high roll. First the violins boiled in vigorous ostinatos under the male vocal, then melted into fluid, lilting arpeggios under the female voices. Chaos melting into a murmur. Her dancers clustered center stage, shifting and morphing in sculptural lifts and lyrical falls to the floor, slow-motion embraces on the middle plane, constantly evolving shapes, bodies passed hand to hand, giving and receiving weight. The combined chorus built up like clouds, which then rolled over, yawning. The strings seemed to drop away, as if the stage were falling asleep. Perfect silence, out of which would arise the Lacrimosa. Now, she was faced with the Rex Tremendae Majestatis, which had to come first, and she was stuck. So she called Trey to procrastinate. He sounded tired, but jubilant.
"Did I tell you I applied for an internship at the British Museum?"
"You did not," she said. "What kind of internship?"
"Curatorial support and assisting with cataloging and care of drawings and watercolors, 17th to 19th century, in case it interests you."
"I'm more of a 16th century kind of girl."
"Damn it."
"Anyway, did you get it?"
"I got it. I'm in."
"Trey," she cried. "You're in."
"This is me. In."
"Congratulations."
"Thank you, thank you. I'd like to say it was a team effort, but it wasn't."
"When does it start?"
"Second week of September."
"Exciting.
What's going on with you? How's construction? Trey asked.
Awful.
Still? Don't worry. You'll think of something.
I got 5 weeks left. I better.
Do you have to do the recs? Are you committed to it? Could you stick to the confutatis?
I could, I guess, she said. But I think, musically speaking, it would sound weird. The confutatis is definitely the middle of a thought, not the start of one.
Good point.
She tapped her pencil on her notes, frowning at the Latin text she'd copied from a book at the library. Confutatis maledictis, she said. What does that even mean?
When the confounded are accused.
She sat up. You know Latin?
12 years of parochial school and a Jesuit college degree, ding dong. Of course I know Latin.
Oh my God, help me.
I'll try.
He let out a groan with accompanying noises that sounded like a body collapsing.
God, I'm tired,
he said, yawning. I've been riding this crest of anticipation for so long. I read the acceptance letter and the bottom fell out.
We don't have to do this now.
No, I want to help you. Come on, speak Latin to me.
Rex tremende majestatis, she said. I know Rex is king. Tremendous, majestical king? His soft laugh curled into her ear.
King of tremendous majesty.
I was close.
Think I'll have to put it on my business card.
You should, she said, smiling. How about Quantus tremor est futurus?
I'm sorry I didn't kiss you when I had the chance.
She looked up as if he were in the room. Is that the literal translation?
Loose.
Her fingers wrapped tight around the pencil and a smug triumph coiled up in her chest. I didn't know you wanted to.
Oh, I wanted. Bad.
His voice was pitched low, husky with an indolent fatigue. It seemed to caress her, or want to be caressed. You wanted to kiss me bad? She said. Or you wanted to kiss me well, you just wanted it badly.
Bad, he said. Cro-Magnon bad. Me, you kiss.
Ung.
She laughed. Why didn't you?
I thought about it when I was giving you the tour at the museum, he said. But every time it seemed the time, I don't know, I guess I was feeling shy, which is the nice way of saying I chickened out.
She curled into his words. No, you were shy.
If I ever see you again, I'm kissing you immediately.
I hope you'll say hello first.
Hello. Can I kiss you? Me, you kiss? Ung.
You don't have to ask, she said, smiling. Just the hello.
Got it. More Latin, please.
Quantus tremor est futurus.
Est, he said. I know the French part of you wants to drop the T. Latin isn't devious that way. Just say it the way you see it.
She repeated the phrase, pronouncing all the letters.
Great trembling will come, he said.
Doesn't coming always involve trembling?
Always with me. You?
Sometimes my teeth chatter.
Thanks for the visual.
Ad te omnis care veniet, she said, and then closed her eyes.
To you all flesh shall come.
And tremble?
Mm-hmm.
She opened her eyes. Quaerens me, sedisti lassus.
Faint and weary, you have sought me.
Are you weary? She imagined his profile in sleep, head nestled against her, his hair falling through her fingers.
No.
The single syllable was both confident and vulnerable. In her daydream, his head lifted. He was awake, eyes filled with lust. Her mouth was dry. Then all at once, it was wet. Then everything was wet. She pressed her thighs together. In gemisco, tamquam reus.
I moan as one who is guilty.
I kind of want you, she whispered, nearly soundless. A swallowed pause.
I kind of want you too, he said. Bad.
The pencil rolled out of her fingers. She slid to lie down as her heart sat up, beating slow and deep, squinting at the unfolding scene with keen, interested eyes. statuens in parte dextra, guiding me to your right hand. Her breath thick and hot in her chest as she pretended him taking her hand, guiding it to the fly of his jeans.
Don't stop, he said.
Her mind pulled an imaginary zipper. Oro supplex et acclinis.
I kneel with submissive heart. God, I want to taste you.
Her reply stumbled, words piling up in her throat. She heard him inhale and exhale. His sigh stroked a single, deliberate finger down her stomach.
I want that too, she said. Bad.
She drew her forearm over her face, blocking out the light, blocking out everything, but his voice. She was flayed open, exposed to the tight, trembling core of frustrated vulnerability. Her body was clutching at his voice, clutching at the want.
I want him.
This is crazy,
Trey said softly. I've never done anything like this, she said. Have you?
Couple times, but I felt like an idiot.
How do you feel now?
Like I want to eat your voice. Like I want to tear the phone apart to get to you.
She pushed her papers off the bed, turned off the lamp and lay down, curled into the dark, and rolled into him.
Trey,
I'm so fucking hard for you.
Ung, she said. Severed. September 7, 1997. Dear Luck. So, Jesus, I'm blushing before I even start. So, Trey came down to DC for the performance last weekend. Oh, wait, let me get the performance out of the way. It went great. Review clipping enclosed. Skim it politely. Done? Good. Back to the matter at hand. Curtain came down, and I took Trey back to the hotel room and had my way with him all night long. Oh my fucking God. Or rather, oh God, my fucking. It was fantastic. The whole business was so frank and unabashed and unapologetic. After a month of intense phone sex, describing in no uncertain terms what we wanted to do with each other, when we finally met up after the show, it was like a 5-second decision, if that. You want to get coffee or go back to the we're going back to the room, right? Who are we kidding? I loved it. I felt so fucking good to want. I haven't had that pure streak of sexual itch in such a long time, and I was really scared I would never feel it again. Seriously, like Eric ruined me for anyone else. He not only pulled the plug on our relationship, but yanked out a few circuits in my libido switchboard for good measure. The switchboard, darling girl, is alive and well. It was beyond hot. And it could have been a total bust, right? Big buildup, and then crash and burn, and disappointment. Nope. Nuh-uh. Came my brains out. Housekeeping pretty much scraped us off the ceiling the next morning. We made a spectacular walk of shame to a diner and had one of those warriors breakfasts, grinning like morons. We did get a little sappy, saying goodbye. Breaks all the rules of a one-night stand, but it's not like he was a total stranger. Sniff. If only we had just one more night. Clutch. Kiss. I'll miss you. Sigh. Sniff. Bittersweet was the word. Yeah. Pause. Stare into space. Anyway, he's safely arrived in London, and in a few weeks, I'll be heading out to Los Angeles. I'm excited to see the West Coast. We're supposed to get a half dozen new cast members. Thank God, because the company is getting on each other's nerves. We're all bickering like siblings. We need some fresh air and some fresh meat. Pause. Stare into space. Got a letter from John. He's doing really well in Boston. Got some outstanding reviews when he played Mercutio in their staging of Romeo and Juliet. He has a new girlfriend, Paola. Will called me last week. He's also doing great things in Frankfurt. He asked how you were and said to say hi to you. No, really, he did. So this is me, as Will. Saying hi to you. Hi. Please take your clothes off. Come on, you laughed. I know you did. Anyway, gotta go now. I love and miss you. Put your damn clothes on. Days. October 10, 1997. Dear Rita,
Have you read The Golden Compass? I met this guy, Trey, and he said, a lot of my story reminded me of the book. He gave me a copy to read on the flight to LA. I'd never heard of it. Now I can't unhear it. I devoured it on the plane, cover to cover, without stopping. It's possibly the most beautiful thing I've ever read. I want a daemon. I love the idea of having your soul manifest itself as a live animal companion you can hold and hug and talk to, a constant counselor and helpmate. I find it somewhat offensive. This does not exist. Why isn't this real? I wonder what my daemon would be. Anyway, I'm not sure you know the plot, but briefly, it involves a sinister plan to separate children from their daemons because doing so releases a great deal of energy. The child usually dies as a result, or else wanders as a soulless outcast, because not having a daemon is horrifying, equivalent to someone not having a face. Trey wrote me a note inside the book's cover. When you read about daemons, I think you will find the word you've been looking for to describe Eric leaving you. He was right. The word is sever. A child without a daemon is called a severed child. When I read that, I actually put the book down in my lap and stared out the window a good 20 minutes, repeating severed over and over in my head. This notion of severing, disconnecting two soulmates, releasing an immeasurable amount of energy, enough to rip a hole in the sky. My head was whirling. It all seemed to make sense. When Eric severed himself from me, all the released energy had to go somewhere. It went back into me. A bullet severed my artery. Its energy caused compartment syndrome, and they had to cut to release it. My lover severed his heart from mine. My entire body developed compartment syndrome, and I had to cut to release it. This is quite a thing to realize at 33,000 feet. So, here I am in La La Land, playing the Pantages Theater until April. It's the longest leg so far. We'll be here 6 months. But I cannot complain because the weather, in a word, is spectacular. After the cold winters in the Great Lakes and the disgusting summer in Foggy Bottom, I cannot get enough of perfect 72-degree day after perfect 72-degree day, and so much to do. All my free time has been a slugfest compared to the action-packed hours we cram in before curtain. Disneyland and Universal Studios and the beach and Hollywood and tours and this attraction, the other attraction. Plus, this is Gabriel's home turf. Our reputation and his hustle precede us, and we have a guest artist spot with the Anaheim Ballet School starting in January. I'm grateful for the delay and looking forward to working just one job for a couple of months. I'm exhausted after the Washington leg, on a whole lot of levels, but it's good. I feel good. Take care, and I'll talk to you soon. Daisy. Native Son Makes Good. December 25, 1997. Dear Trey, I thought I would be blue being on the road during the holidays, but it's actually been one of the most festive seasons I've had in a long time. The company takes excellent care of its own, and nobody is left alone or out in the cold. We had an epic Thanksgiving dinner at Melissa, and last night's post-show supper was a total bacchanal, being both the first night of Hanukkah and Christmas Eve. Your package arrived at the theater about a week ago, but I held off opening it until today. How did you know I would love a copy of The Subtle Knife? You shouldn't have, but I'm awful glad you did. Can't wait to crack the spine and fall into the next part of Golden Compass. Funny, I've waited so long to read this, and I know I'll tear through it in 2 days. Books can break your heart that way. Looking ahead, Gabe and I start our guest artist stint with Anaheim Ballet School after New Year's. The plan is to stage Rakewind for their spring recital. Phantom will load out in April, and then it's back to Chicago. I'm getting a little tired and wondering if it's time to bow out. I feel homesick, but in a confused way, like I'm not quite sure which home I mean. New York? Philly? A new home? Anyway, the theater is dark and the company is hosting another dinner tonight. Much booze and caroling and unveiling of Secret Santas. I hope you've had a merry little everything, King of Tremendous Majesty, and may the new year bring much coming and trembling. Not necessarily in that order. Love and Ung. Days. Daisy closed the card and slid it into its envelope. Trey preferred email, but it was Christmas. He'd get a card and be happy. She stood up and went to the window, drew back the heavy drape to look out at the bowl of Los Angeles. Strange to see the silhouette of palm trees at Christmas, a desert vista instead of snowdrifts. The holiday decor seemed so tatty and out of context. Her CD player whirred and changed discs. Nat King Cole began crooning the Christmas song. Loneliness laid gentle hands on her shoulders. From a bookcase in her heart, she took down a photo album and thumbed through old snapshots of La Tarasque, decorating the tree, handing up ornaments to Eric, who hung them on the highest branches. The memory wreathed in the scent of wood smoke and pine and orange spice cookies. Do you ever think of marrying me? She put her hand on the window pane and looked through her reflection to the city outside. Time and accomplishment had dulled the pain to an ache. Yet rare were the days when Eric didn't float through her mind for one reason or another. Where are you? She didn't often let herself lean into it, but now she pressed her forehead against the glass. Her breath drained from her lungs, fogging the sparkling clump of lights. I'm lonely tonight. I'm thinking of you. It still matters. I'm still sorry. And I still love you. Come back, she whispered. Come back to me. The Los Angeles Times, February 15, 1998. An evening with the Anaheim Ballet. The program ended with Rakewind, the work of guest artist Marguerite Bianco. Set to Mozart's haunting Requiem Mass, the ballet is a tribute to the victims of the 1992 shooting at Lancaster University, where Bianco did her undergraduate work. The ballet opens with the Introitus, with Bianco center stage in the circle of a single spotlight. The stage then explodes with a dies irae, a rolling boil of nonstop movement and emotion through which Bianco slices, sometimes like a sword, other times like a ribbon. Rex Tremendae Majestatis features six dancers, one for each of the dead at Lancaster shootings, and Gabriel Osten, who dances the same choreography but with his back to the audience. One might think this was done in ostracism, or perhaps to see through the eyes of a disturbed and marginalized youth driven to the unthinkable. Confutatis Maledictis juxtaposes euphoria against darkness, community against outcasts. A clump of undulating bodies keeping Bianco and Osten separated. The clump dissipates, and silence is broken by the tentative notes of the Lacrimosa. The climactic pas de deux starts as a duet in unison and evolves into Bianco and Osten's breathtaking partner work against the core carrying candles. At the final amen, the combined company constructs a multi-tiered cathedral of bodies under which the couple embrace. Bianco's choreography is fierce, but never maudlin. She dances with the honesty of a storyteller. The ballet's goal is not to garner pity, but to create understanding. And this young artist triumphs on both fronts. March 10, 1998. Dear Days.
Was ist los, du Arschloch?
So glad my customary greeting doesn't get lost in translation.
Dude, I bawled like a girl reading the review of Rakewind. Did anyone videotape it? Seriously, I cannot live much longer without seeing this piece. I feel like I've been with you the whole time it was being choreographed,
over the space of a year and across four cities.
Now I'm dying to see it live. And hopefully a greater chance exists, because starting April, I'll be on the same continent as you. Let me back up. Last November, my dad had to have heart surgery. I came home a couple weeks, and long story short, he's doing well with good prognosis, but it's been hard on my mom. You know, I got one sister out in Vancouver and the other in Oregon. Maurice and the Pompidus are pretty well entrenched in the Moncton community, but let's face it, they move in circles their age and nobody's getting younger. Still, it's not their plan to move out west yet, if ever. Cue problem of what's a good son to do, and enter solution in the form of Andre Mejia, my old teacher from Ballet Canadien. He now heads New Brunswick Ballet Theater and is seriously feeling my shit up.
He's offered me a guest artist spot for the spring and summer with a possible principal contract for the fall season. Native son makes good and comes home. I'm not going to think it to death. It's the perfect solution for the problem du jour. And I'm ready to leave Europe anyway. My work here is done on a lot of levels, and I know that's cryptic and annoying, but one day I'll explain it better, or write my autobiography. Anyway, enough about me. Daze, I'm so fucking proud of you. Everything you've done, and everywhere you've been, and your whole evolution into the artist I always knew you were. The only thing that sucks is I'm not closer to see it. And in case I've been stupid enough to not mention it, I've danced in 3 companies in 3 countries, and have yet to find a partner like you. We need to dance together again. Someday soon. Love and shit. Will. Or Carell. September 6, 1998. Dear Rita, thanks again for finding time to see me before you left New York. Isn't life ironic? I hang up my gypsy shoes and come home to the Big Apple, and now you've pulled up roots and headed to the good life in Vermont. I hope it's everything you wish for and more. And I hope you don't mind me still writing. Even though you don't answer back, it feels like you're listening as I sort stuff out on paper. Gabriel left the Phantom Tour as well. He's living with a friend down in Soho while I'm back at my place on West 86th. Squeezed in with Lucky, but she's looking around for new digs. And she's lovely to squeeze with. I missed her. Gabriel is still full of nerve and hustle, and I follow him from class to audition, to workshop, to class to audition. Pounding the pavement in New York is a thankless business, especially as the balance in the bank account steadily dwindles. Last week, we auditioned for a relatively new company. They're called Ballet or Corral, only in their 5th year and just starting to pick up speed. They choreograph primarily to chamber music and have an affiliated string ensemble. The company has about 30 members right now. They just secured a huge grant from the Schubert Foundation and signed a lease on a beautiful studio space in Harlem. They do a month-long season at City Center and then tour a lot of venues in the New York metropolitan area. Gabe and I have been to see Or Carell in performance twice now, and I love their range. They do some short works from the classical repertory, but their original ballets set to the string ensemble are amazing. Brilliant and breathless choreography. I can barely sit still when I watch. And when I was at the audition class in their new space, I had this strong, unexplainable sensation of being home, to the point where I'm jumping when the phone rings. I want to dance with this company. So say a little prayer for me that the phone rings soon with some kind of work. Until then, it's off to class I go. Hope all is well in your new life. Take good care. Daisy. The Village Voice, November 16, 1998. Ballet or Carell at City Center. The second half of the evening was devoted to the premiere of Primo Verre, Ballet or Carell's tribute to springtime when a young man's fancy inevitably turns to thoughts of love. The ballet is set to the first section of Karl Orff's Carell masterpiece, Carmina Burana. The opening sequence, Fortuné Plango Vulnera, sets the tone of celebration and joy, anchored by the flying leaps and turns of Tunisian-born Anwar Bougini. Verre's L'état facies heralds the entrance of Or Carell's newest artist, the mesmerizing Marguerite Bianco. Formerly with the Metropolitan Opera Ballet, Bianco is by far the finest dancer to be seen at Or Carell, and clearly the company displays her as the greatest of its treasures. Bianco has a sinewy grace and frank sensuality, both qualities perfectly framed within her stunning technique. In tiny, skillful mannerisms, a slight overextension on her arms, a tiny arch of the back, and most of all, the remarkable use of her eyes, she subtly reveals her prowess, chipping away Borghini's resolve until he can do nothing but take her in his arms, which he does in Omnia Sol Temperat, a tender but chemical pas de deux. Primo Verre is an uplifting work full of innovative choreography and inherent emotion. Anchored by Bianco and Borghini, the result is a glorious tribute to love. Fire, Flood, or Apocalypse. April 19, 1999. Dear Rita, I haven't written in a while, but for a good reason. Amazing things have been happening. Last fall, I entered Rakewind in Capizio's ACE competition, Award for Choreographic Excellence. In February, the 15 finalists were announced, and Rakewind was chosen. At the end of March, we presented at the Dance Teacher Summit, and holy shit, I won! It's a $10,000 prize, but the recognition that comes with it has been priceless. Now the phone is ringing with people wanting me to come teach and do workshops and stage choreography. I still can't believe it. It is, to date, the most incredible thing ever to happen to me professionally. The night itself was pure magic on so many levels. We performed at the Brooklyn Academy of Music. My parents came. Lucky, of course, was there. And best of all, Will was able to come. He joined New Brunswick Ballet Theatre last fall, and he arranged to take the time off and finally see this piece I've been telling him about for so long in letters and emails. Well, after the performance and the awards, it took me forever to get from backstage out into the house. My parents went ahead to secure dinner reservations and a case of champagne. So I came out into the lobby myself, and off to the side, I saw Lucky and Will. They hadn't seen each other in 6 years. I hadn't seen them together in 6 years. They were hugging. Daisy put her pen down and rubbed her cold hands, smiling back at the memory of her two best friends caught up tight in each other's arms. Lucky had wormed her hands between the lapels of Will's jacket, slid them around and up between his shoulder blades. Curved over her, he looked hunchbacked. His hand was at the back of her head, buried in her curls. They rocked and swayed gently within the embrace, but their stance was immutable. Only fire, flood, or apocalypse could move them. Or Daisy, who shamelessly wormed her way between them like a demanding child, gathering them into her arms and kissing each tear-streaked face. "I totally planned this," she said.
"Well planned,"
Will said, dragging the heel of his hand across his eyes. It took a good half hour for them to let go of each other, mop up, and make their way to the restaurant. All through the late supper with the Biancos, Will and Lucky kept glancing sideways at each other with bright, emotion-ringed eyes. Daisy didn't need to drop her napkin to know their legs were probably cozied up beneath the table. Outside the restaurant, she kissed and hugged them, suggested brunch the next morning. "But whatever you want, call me, whenever." And she walked off with her parents, leaving Will and Lucky to sort the rest of the evening out on their own. She picked up her pen and went back to writing. The upshot is Lucky has gone to Canada 4 times in the past 2 months, and although I haven't seen any of their reconciliation personally, I can feel it when I hang out with her. She's all lit up inside, but her feet are still planted on the ground. I want to cry at the thought of them back together. It gives me hope that... Her cell phone rang, followed by her regular phone. "It's me," Lucky said on her cell. "Have you..." "Hold on," Daisy said, and she yanked the house phone from its cradle. "Hello?"
"It's me," Gabriel said. "Have you seen the TV?"
"What?" Daisy said. "Hold on." She switched phones. "Hey, I have Gabe on the other line. Let me..."
"Turn on the TV," Lucky said. "I'm coming over."
She hung up. Daisy wrinkled her eyebrows at the dead screen, then turned her ear back to Gabriel. "What's going on?"
"Turn on the TV."
"What channel?"
"Any channel."
"Did someone die?" She clicked the remote. The screen flamed to life and centered on the NBC news desk. The anchor's earnest face filled the screen. To the right, a graphic of the state of Colorado. Denver, next to a star. A smaller dot beneath it, slightly to the left, with the word Littleton. Across the top of the graphic flashed 2 words. "School shooting."
"I'm coming over," Gabriel said.
Daisy's hand with the phone lowered into her lap. She stared at the screen, the news exploding from the open wound that was Columbine High School, spraying in green glass shards onto her living room floor. Lucky stayed all day. They ordered in and parked on chairs and on the couch, watching the news. "We should take a break," one of them would say occasionally. They walked down to Riverside Park and back over to Lincoln Center, picked up ice cream or cigarettes, and went back to the apartment. The phone rang and rang.
"Are you all right, darling?" Francine said.
It's so terrible.
I'm not sure what I am, Daisy said.
Don't be alone. Is Lulu there with you?
I'm practically sitting in her lap, Lucky said loudly. I'm not leaving.
Call us, Joe said. 4 in the morning, don't worry. Wake us up, come home if you need to.
I will,
Daisy said, and hung up, only to answer another ring minutes later.
Oh, Daisy,
John said.
I feel sick.
I hate conversations that start this way,
he said.
Are you alone?
I'm at the theater, of all places. Oddly, I feel safest here. Who's with you?
Lucky.
Stay together tonight. Don't be alone.
I will. You be safe too. Call me.
Colleagues from both the Metropolitan Opera and Orcarelle called, wanting to know if she was all right. Friends she made on the Phantom Tour. Calls came in from Cleveland, D.C., and Los Angeles.
Are you all right?
I'm watching the news. I thought of you. It's so terrible.
I'm thinking about you. It must be like reliving it. Are you all right?
A crackling, delayed voice from across the ocean.
God, Daisy,
Trey said.
Your heart must be torn apart.
How quickly her mouth formed, I'm okay, and wanted to push it out and not be a bother. She let it dissolve and looked for something more truthful as she leaned into their concern.
I feel terrible, she said.
Lucky paced from kitchen to bedroom and back, talking to Will on her cell. She passed him to Daisy after Trey hung up.
I wish I were there,
Will said.
I need to be with both of you.
I know,
she said.
Oh, Will.
Nothing is going to be the same for them. Her heart waxed and waned like the moon. First, it was dark and numb, shielding its face. Then a sliver of feeling broke through, curved and stretched and expanded as she took in the children being shepherded by police across lawns and parking lots, their hands on their heads, the cutaways to witnesses, the uncertainty and chaos, a palpable film across the television screen, until her heart was wide open and wailing, tearing its hair and rending its garment, raising a voice filled with agony.
How? Why?
To the ends of the universe. Then it sank to its knees, retreated within, curled down into a crescent, then hit again.
Enough, Lucky said.
No more TV. It's the same damn thing over and over again. Daisy lit candles and put on some classical music. Is this good? Lucky said, pulling Daisy's much-worn copy of The Golden Compass from the shelves. More than good. It's my life. Bach soothed Daisy's crackly nerves. She found the hole in her own book and tumbled into it, grateful to leave the world behind. Lucky, however, seemed to grow more agitated, sighing frequently, casting murderous looks at the phone until finally she tossed the book aside and fired a throw pillow across the room. Ring, damn it, she cried. Call, motherfucker, what the fuck is wrong with you?
Jesus, Daisy said.
What's the matter? I can't believe he won't call you today. Lucky smacked her feet down on the floor and began pacing again. Who won't call? Lucky whirled around, her curls snapping like they were filled with electric rage. Fish! Daisy stared. Jesus Christ, he can't let down his veil of stubborn pride and call you in the wake of another shooting? Can he stop being your cuckolded ex for 10 seconds and just be a human being, a fellow survivor?
Look,
Daisy said. But Lucky was unleashed now. Is he that heartless? What the fuck, Daisy? I don't understand, and it pisses me off. I'm so angry with him. It's all right. No, it's not all right. You had sex with another guy. It was shitty and hurtful, but for crying out loud, you didn't murder his mother. This relentless silent treatment is bullshit. Spent and deflated, Lucky sank back into her chair, viciously gnawing at her thumbnail. Who the fuck does he think he is? A sweet boy with a bitter palate, Daisy said, staring at the darkening windows. She closed her eyes, and the tender core of her heart unfolded and reached soft tendrils into the coming night, where wolves were lurking, hungry for the kill.
Eric, where are you?
She thought.
Are you safe?
A hound's snarling exhale replied. She raised her chin a little,
Refuse to be afraid. You don't have to answer, Eric. Just be safe. Behind her closed eyelids, her mind's edges began to soften. Her palms, of their own volition, rolled upward in her lap. She came in peace. Sweet boy, be safe. April 23, 1999. I was interrupted before by the news from Columbine. It took over everything for a little while, as you can imagine. I'm not all right. I'm heartbroken and haunted, but... And I'm letting myself feel it and reaching out to talk about it. So many people called me the day of, wanting to know if I was okay. They wouldn't have if I hadn't let Lancaster become an ordinary part of my history, if I hadn't learned to share my scars and my story. I see that now. It's easy to see so many things now. A candlelight vigil and service was held in Damrosch Park. Orcarell performed Rakewind at the Bandshell. At the end of the Lacrimosa, when the corps filled up the stage with their candles, and I looked out over the sea of candle flames filling up the park, I felt such a sense of serenity. Peace caught me up under my ribcage and lifted me out of myself. I was floating, rising over the park and New York and the world, remembering how Trey translated the text for me. Lux aeterna luceat eis. Lux perpetua luceat eis. Let eternal light shine on them. Let perpetual light shine on them. And qua resurget ex favilla, from the ashes, shall rise again. I'm thinking of having it tattooed over one of my scars. Next time Lucky goes up to Canada, I'm going with her. I want to see Will, and I was also invited to audition for New Brunswick Ballet Theater. Maybe it's time for a change. I can't lie and say the thought of dancing with Will again has no appeal. The daydream of him, Lucky and me being together in one place, makes me feel incredibly happy, too. But I'm getting ahead of myself. I'll go up there and audition and see what comes of it. I'm not quite all right, but I'm mostly right. I hope you are, too. Talk to you soon. Daisy. Room 473. The St. John Telegraph Journal. September 26, 1999. New Brunswick Ballet Theater, Goodies from Oldies. The debut of New Brunswick Ballet Theater's Nostalgia Ballet Standard Saturday night was the feel-good sensation of the year, a joyful night around the radio with songs from the golden age of big band to highlights of the Grand Ole Opry. Ballet met ballroom, and NBBT's dancers stretched both their styles and their hearts to create a celebration of music, lyrics, and movement. Dinah Shore's Shoe Fly Pie, the Andrews sisters' By Mir Bis Du Schön, Tommy Dorsey's Opus 1, and Nat King Cole's L-O-V-E are a few of the gems embedded in the necklace of this delightful ballet. William Kager's rollicking, caffeinated solo to Frank Sinatra's The Coffee Song is not to be missed. Neither is Rosemary Clooney's Come On to My House, danced by NBBT's newest principal, Marguerite Bianco. If you don't walk out of the theater in love with this blue-eyed American ballerina, you have no pulse. Kager and Bianco together in Patsy Cline's Crazy is nothing less than magic. They have known each other since college, and their offstage friendship lends itself to an onstage partnership of the highest order. The ballet ends with Louis Prima's Buonasera. The company goes from tango to swing and blows the roof off the Imperial Theater. The audience is left crackling with infectious joy and a bittersweet longing for the good old days. Moncton Times and Transcript, April 10, 2000. Kager and Dare joined in marriage. William Maurice Kager and Lucia Grace Dare were joined in marriage on April 8 at the Algonquin Resort in St. Andrews by the Sea. The groom is the son of Maurice and Siegelin Kager of Moncton. The bride is the daughter of Thomas Dare of Riverside, California, and Judith Dare Millerton of Pearl River, New York. The best man was the father of the groom. The bride was attended by her close friend, Marguerite Bianco. Both Dare and Kager are graduates of Lancaster University in Pennsylvania. Kager was a Brighton Scholarship winner in 1988 and holds a Bachelor of Fine Arts in Dance.
He was a core member with the National Ballet of Canada and a soloist with the Frankfurt Ballet. He joined the London Festival Ballet for a year before returning to his native Canada and becoming a principal dancer with the New Brunswick Ballet Theatre. Dare holds a master's degree in physical therapy and works in a private practice in St. John. By request, the couple stayed in the resort's infamous Room 473, which, according to legend, is haunted by a jilted bride who died there in the early 1900s. They planned a honeymoon in the Caribbean. Against Your Door. April 11, 2002. Dear Rita, I'm going back to Lancaster this weekend. It's the 10-year anniversary of the shooting, and the university planned a memorial ceremony. They're rededicating the auditorium to my ballet teacher, Marie. The conservatory invited Will and I to perform, so we contacted the Balanchine Trust and asked permission to dance The Man I Love. They not only gave it to us, but one of the trustees told us any time and any place we wanted to dance it, we may. A beautiful gesture, but as we've been rehearsing the past few weeks, Will and I pretty much agree this will probably be the last time. It's too much. But never say never, right? After all, I am going back, and I swore I never would. How does that feel? I can hear you say. I am, honestly, a little bit of a wreck. Like refill the Xanax wreck. I don't know who will be there. Translation, I don't know if Eric will be there. He might, or he might not. And I don't know which would be more difficult, frankly. Of course I want to see him. But if he's there and he's cold or distant or avoids me or... Be brave, Days. Say it out loud. If he's married. Ugh. And again, there's something to be said for finding out. If he's cold, he's cold. If he's married, he is. If I know, then I know and I can go from there. It's best I go in with the expectation of being aloofly avoided at worst or introduced to his beautiful wife at best. Actually, reverse those. Cause of death? Eh. On the positive side, it's not like I'm walking in there alone. I'm flying down with Will and Lucky on Thursday. John is coming as well from Boston. And I'm beside myself knowing I'll see my old teacher, Case Giusti. I've talked to him on the phone a few times, making arrangements, and he's the same wonderful, wonderful soul. So full of love and energy, a total emotional hamburger with fries on the side. I can't wait to see him. Another exciting thing is that National Public Radio is covering the ceremony. The segment will run on their show, Moments in Time. I'll give you a heads up when I find out the date. So, off I go to war. If it's bad, I will divert the return trip through Vermont and throw myself against your office door. I'll warn you by phone first. Promise. Take good care. And I'll talk to you soon. Daisy. First the voice, then the heart. Arms dropped to her sides. Daisy stood in wings of the theater, letting the waves of sensory nostalgia crash onto her head. The distinctive backstage odor of sweat, sawdust, musty velvet curtains, and damp concrete walls engulfed her. Taped down cables were underfoot, and the catwalk was overhead. The disorderly order of everything hadn't changed. The same haphazard stacks of sets, the cubicles for quick costume changes, the stage manager's station, and the memories. Everywhere. Waving wildly, rushing up to throw arms around her neck, bury their heads in her shoulder and sob, "Remember me? Remember me?" Daisy held them, patted and caressed them. "Of course I remember. Of course." She ran her hand along the two freestanding bars where she warmed up countless times over the course of 4 years. She put her feet in a loose first position and closed her eyes, breathed in again, her heart pounding. She knew it would be hard. "Just let it be hard," she thought. "It's hard. It's sad. It's emotional. Let it be what it is." Leaving the bar, she walked over to a wall of wooden pigeonholes, each little compartment labeled with a name. Daisy reverently touched the fourth cubby from the left, third row, now labeled Browning, but once upon a time, Bianco. "This was mine. I lived here. I danced here. I loved here.
I was shot here.
A rectangle of white had been painted on the wall above the mailboxes. The memorial plaques for the shooting victims would be hung here on Sunday. At dinner last night, Kay said some disagreement between the families and the school surrounded the placement. Administration wanted them hung in the lobby. The families insisted their fallen loved ones would have wanted them here, in the thick of production, not alone and isolated in the cold, formal lobby. Their lives and passions had been backstage, where they died doing what they loved.
I lived here. I died here.
She crossed to the stage left wings. The Mylar floor hadn't yet been rolled out, and the heels of her boots were loud and hollow on the wood planks. Will and Lucky were crouched in the curtains, in silent reflection together. 5 shot dead here. Eyewitness accounts from survivors differed slightly, but one was undisputed. Trevor King, the assistant stage manager, was first to fall.
When he has a squad in his crosshairs, a sniper almost always shoots the communications man first,
Joe Bianco once told his daughter.
He takes out the voice. Then he'll go for the smallest man in the squad because, psychologically, the other men view him as the baby. No matter his age, rank, strength, or personality, the shortest man is the kid brother. Shoot him, and you shoot the heart of the squad. So first, the voice, then the heart.
James Dow, whose sister was a soldier, took out Trevor, who died still wearing his headset. Then James turned and shot Manuel Sabena, 5 feet, 5 inches tall. Allison Pierce, one of the stagehands, fell next. Then Taylor Revelle, with her knitting stuffed down the front of her shirt. And last, Aisha Johnson. One by one, they fell to the scuffed planks. And just like in the movies, the police outlined them in tape. The bodies were taken away. The tape stayed. And in the days after the shooting, the students crept back into the theater and began to fill in the white outlines with signatures and messages. When the tape was pulled up, 5 bodies remained memorialized on the floor. The custodial staff varnished over them every year. Dancers, actors, and musicians gathered around them before performance.
And still do, Kay said at dinner. 10 years later, when nobody who was there is here. It's legend. It's lore. They pick a shrine and pray to it.
Case was 47 now. His eyebrows were shot through with gray. His eyes were circled, but they still sparkled with an undefeatable spirit. And his hands couldn't get enough of them. Over and across the table at the restaurant, they darted and swooped, patting Lucky's 5-month pregnant belly, rubbing circles on Will's back, and sandwiching Daisy's own trembling fingers.
So good to see you, he kept saying. God, you're beautiful. Look at you. I'm so glad you're here.
I'm here,
Daisy whispered now, crouching down by Taylor's outlined body. Tracing a finger, she found her own farewell words. K1, P2, don't forget, ILU. Lucky knelt beside her, silently passing a tissue.
Jesus,
Daisy mumbled thanks. My hormones can't take this, Lucky said. Daisy stood up, her knees popping. Wiping her eyes, she went back onto the stage and exhaled heavily as she finally looked the maw of the theater in the face, cavernous and solemn. Stretching up high and wide, lanterns lined up like soldiers along the bars, their cables neatly coiled and taped. Industrial. Productive. Yet the rows of seats curved toward her like arms, making the space intimate. Draped in soft curtains, 2 worlds meeting to create a 3rd universe where magical things happened.
Like me and Eric,
she thought, looking toward the lighting booth, its windows shining and intact, but dark and empty within.
Isn't it time? Can't we talk about it?
He was either coming or he wasn't, and she'd wait and look for him until he showed up, or until she went home. If only she could know. Then she could stop surfing this awful wave of anticipation. Even now, her heart lurched sideways as a man who certainly wasn't Eric came into the theater, looking left and right, hands stuffed into the pockets of his jacket. His gaze stopped on Daisy, Then his hands pulled free, his arms flung wide. Like a hero, he came running down the aisle. Daisy's face turned warm with pleasure, pulling wide toward her ears. Without thinking, she ran to the edge of the apron and jumped. John caught her, crushed her to his chest, and spun in a circle.
"Oh, John," she said against his neck.
"I love conversations that start this way."
"Thank God you're here."
"It's terrible to see you."
She laughed, rubbing her wet face on his shoulder.
"This is brutal."
"Tell me about it." I parked my car and started crying.
He set her down and stepped back, hands on hips. His copper eyes looked her up and down, a corner of his mouth twisting.
"I think we should set some ground rules. Are you dating anyone? Because if not, I'm going to be shamelessly clutching you all weekend."
She wrapped herself in his handsome appeal, letting it be what it was. "Fuck rules. Clutchez-moi." His arms scooped her up again and hugged her tight. She pressed her lips against his jaw. Over his shoulder, she saw another man had come into the theater, standing in much the same way, hands in pockets, looking up and down as well as left and right. He wore a black watch cap pulled low. Daisy's heart didn't bother with a lurch. This man's build was far too slight and lean. Still, something about him made her tilt her head and squint, the hair on the back of her neck stirring.
"Who's that?"
she said.
John turned, still holding her. His arms loosened and Daisy's feet touched the carpet.
"Dave?"
John said. The air reared back in Daisy's throat. She pulled from John's embrace and started walking up the aisle. It couldn't be. David was a burly and solid bear, not this rail-thin, stoop-shouldered person with jeans that bagged in the legs. As she drew nearer, the facial features coalesced. It was David, and yet not. As if he'd been disassembled and put back together. Backward. A David avatar. Something was almost alien about his features. She couldn't put her finger on it. Not until she was 5 feet away and he reached up and slowly drew off the watch cap. His hairless pate shone under the lights. A bit of stubble was growing in his sideburns and it sparked silver. As the gap between them closed, she realized what was so disturbing about his face. He had no eyebrows or eyelashes.
"David,"
she said.
"Qu'est-ce qu'il y a?"
He smiled.
"It looks worse than it is,"
he said.
"And it's better than it was."
"Oh my God,"
she said under her breath and put her arms around him. He seemed to jump in his skin, laughed as if her embrace surprised him.
"Marge,"
he said.
"God damn it, you're still the prettiest thing I ever saw in my life."
And finally he hugged her back. A stampede of footsteps behind Daisy. John was there, and Lucky, and Will. They piled on in the aisle, arms weaving around and through in a wreath of welcome.
"Opie, you prince," David said. "Look at you, all grown up. And Lulu, holy shit, you're knocked up. Who got lucky with Lucky?" "Get your hands off my wife," Will said, kissing David's bald crown. "Get your hands off my ass."
Lucky ran her palm over David's face.
"What happened to you?"
I'm fine," he said. "Life kicked me in the kidneys, but I'm all right."
"Cancer?"
Daisy said. David nodded.
"What a bitch, huh?"
He looked around and sniffed.
"I survived cancer only to be killed by this place. Jesus, it's the same. It's all here."
"Still here,"
Will said.
"What, am I the only stagehand representation?" David asked. "No other rats came?"
A voice boomed from the lobby doors.
"This rat came."
"He's here,"
Daisy thought, although she knew it wasn't Eric. The voice was wrong. David broke from the group and loped up the aisle into the arms of Neil Martinez. They swayed and rocked side to side, slapping and pummeling. The others moved up toward them. Neil reached past David to grab and touch the men, to kiss Daisy and Lucky.
"Holy beefcake, dude,"
John said, punching Neil's massive shoulders. Neil laughed. He was always handsome in a Latin lover way, but now he was twice the size, like a bodybuilder. Smooth, dark skin with twin dimples, a nearly hairless head, and a trim salt-and-pepper beard. You look like Hector Elizondo, Lucky said, holding his face between her palms.
I'm telling you, bald is hot, David said. You haven't lived until you felt a woman's inner thighs on your naked pate. Right, Neil?
Neil grinned, but within Lucky's hands, his eyes were brimming, and they darted about the theater in a nervous volley. The day of the shooting, Neil had been sick. Dedicated, he dragged himself in late, slightly feverish and muffling a cough into a fist. He'd been behind the Manhattan skyline set with David when James walked in. Together, they hit the floor, and through a crack between two faux buildings, they watched it all. And Neil had never been the same after. Like a bottle of soda left open, he'd gone flat. Big as a pile of boulders, Neil hugged David again now, his hands still padding and thumping, but gradually they grew still. The fingers curled into fists, clutching David's jacket. The brawny shoulders shivered. How his massive frame crumpled against David's slight one tore at Daisy's heart.
It's all right, man,
David said. He pulled up tall and seemed to expand.
We're gonna get through this together.